May it please the court, my name is Adam Richard Little of the law firm Ballew Hazen. I'm the attorney for the appellant, Jessica Nelms, and I've reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal. Before I begin, would the court like a brief recitation of the facts?
We're well familiar with the facts.
Yes. Okay,
so if you want to jump right into
Absolutely.
Your argument, that's fine.
There are three issues here that we're going to be addressing today, Your Honors. First, and it's going to be a little bit different from the way it's normally analyzed, but we went with what we believe the most important issue to be, is the inequitable division of the marital estate on its face. Flowing off of that, the second issue is that there was an improper credit of two premarital assets. Finally, the custody award was inconsistent with the child's best interests. The standard of review in this case on all issues is a review de novo on the record for an abuse of discretion. When this court reviews the record de novo, we would ask that you reverse and remand both on the division of property and classification of the assets, as well as the custody determination. Turning to the first issue, division of the marital estate in this case was inequitable on its face. Now, first, the law, we acknowledge that the property division is not subject to a precise mathematical formula. The ultimate test in determining the appropriateness is reasonableness as determined on the facts. It must turn on that reasonableness and circumstances of each case, and it's appropriate for this court to look at the duration of the marriage, contributions to the marriage, including the fact that a significant portion of the marital estate is the result of one party bringing a substantial premarital net worth into the marriage. That case was Ostentowski v. Ostentowski, decided by the Nebraska Supreme Court. It bears some similarity here to the division of the estate. In that case, the marriage was of a short duration, less than 2 years. Similar here, the marriage was of short duration. The husband in that case brought in significant net worth in premarital or in stored grain. He ran a grain operation. And the trial court in that case ultimately awarded the wife a significant portion of that because he was unable to trace the value of that premarital grain. The Supreme Court, in analyzing, upheld the district court's determination of a lack of tracing. However, the court did acknowledge that the primary value of the marital estate was generated as a direct result of his premarital net worth. It wouldn't exist if he didn't have several hundred thousand dollars of premarital grain. Now, looking at the facts in this case, the appellant, Ms. Nelms, brought in $178,000 of net worth at the time of the marriage, while as Mr. Nelms brought in $16,000. So right off the bat, their marital estate is generated through the use of those assets. In particular, use of her premarital assets as collateral to acquire marital property, as well as her high credit rating. Now, on its face, the division of the property in this case awarded Mr. Nelms 57% of the marital estate. And this is separate from the premarital classification issues. Ms. Nelms only received 43%. Now, we acknowledge that the rule generally is that one-third to one-half is appropriate. However, under the analysis from Ostentowski, we would urge this court to look at the fact this marital estate would not have existed to the extent it did but for her premarital net worth. So to award Mr. Nelms a significantly larger portion of the marital estate when she was the one who helped generate a majority of it is inequitable and unjust, and we urge this court to find an abuse of discretion. There are two other issues related to the equitable nature of the division. The second one is that the district court abused its discretion in failing to require Mr. Nelms to refinance the marital home, which was the most significant asset remaining. With no time requirement whatsoever, it puts her, it leaves her financially tied to Mr. Nelms indefinitely. But more concerning is that it puts her at risk of negative actions by Mr. Nelms. In fact, the record demonstrates that he failed to make several mortgage payments, and her attorney, or his attorney, acknowledged in post-trial motions on the record that he failed to make a payment. We're only a few months out of trial and he's already failing to do that. That is putting her at an unreasonable risk, and it should have had some requirement to refinance or force the sale of the home, because the whole purpose here is to financially separate them so they can go about their lives.
Was that requested at trial?
It was requested at trial. It was also requested in post-trial motions and denied both times, which we believe to be an abuse of discretion.
And did the district court give a reason for the denial of that request?
I don't recall if there was any specific reason. I believe it was just simply denied in the motion. It also de facto prohibits Ms. Nelms from borrowing to find another home herself because it severely inhibits her debt-to-income ratio because it still shows on her credit report. To leave that indefinitely.
Was there any opposition to that request from the husband?
Yes, they opposed it. They wanted to leave things exactly as they were because they got a heck of a deal, which is why we believe it's inequitable in this case. The final thing that's inequitable is the duration of the equalization payments. The court allowed Mr. Nelms to have 4 years, 4 installments to make this equalization payment with no interest in the order. That is longer than the duration of the marriage. Ms. Nelms had this significant premarital net worth and was unable to access it for a significant period of time. It's giving him an unjust financial windfall by allowing him all this time to have essentially an interest-free loan to go about his business. We believe the more appropriate avenue here would be to either reverse the award of the sale of the home is one solution, to require him to refinance in a set period of time, or sell the home if he is unable to, or finally, to require a more concise repayment of the equalization payment, as well as impose interest on that. Now, related to this issue is the incorrect classification of two pieces of premarital property. again, to the Ostentowski case, separate property becomes marital through commingling if it is inextricably mixed with marital property. If it remains segregated, or more importantly, is traceable into its product, commingling does not occur. I'm going to be very brief on these issues and rely on my briefs for the remainder of it, but there are 2 points. First is related to the sale of a premarital Tahoe. It was sold for $30,000. There's no dispute that it was premarital, no dispute that it was sold for $30,000, and that it was deposited into a joint account. Mr. Nelm specifically testified the sole purpose of that sale was for the acquiring of to facilitate the purchase of their marital home. They bought the home. She was properly credited $18,000 for the down payment. No other source of significant funds was available for that. The issue is the remaining $12,000. Within a few weeks of the purchase of the home, they had to install an air filtration system. They had to install a new furnace. They had to install new carpet, totaling $16,402. That also includes an additional $3,281 that was paid out of that account towards another down payment. All of this amounts to an issue of tracing, and we believe the very short duration and the fact that the only source of this significant amount of funds was from that sale is sufficient. She met her burden, and she should be credited for the remaining amount.
Was there any evidence that those improvements, I mean, accepting what you're saying is correct, that the money for these improvements was from premarital funds, was there any evidence shown that increased the value of the home?
We believe that absolutely did, in that the home needed these repairs to gain the value that it had. Now, the home's not been sold, so we don't have an appraisal or something to determine what that exact amount was.
Don't we need to have something like that? I mean, don't we need to be able to tell whether the home, whether that improved the value of the home? Because as all of us homeowners know, we can put money into
right.
our homes, and it doesn't make the home more valuable. It just maintains
We analogize it to the down payment, that these payments were necessary in order to occupy the home, and that the only source of those funds were her premarital contribution. Second issue is the identification of a 2008 Suburban was acquired with premarital funds. That's correct. It was sold. But the issue that the court erroneously included $10,000 in proceeds on the ledger despite identifying it as a premarital asset, which was a double dip. Furthermore, the court incorrectly classified her premarital amount as $16,000, not $18,000. The record supports that.
But you'd agree that it's really what's at issue is the $15,000 in proceeds that would arguably be premarital since that's what she sold it for. That was the value.
She sold it for... $18,000 is what she sold it for.
She did, or she bought it for that?
Or excuse me, she bought it for that, correct.
And sold it for $15,000. So is it the value of her premarital property now at that point only $15,000?
We would concede that would be correct. But its most important issue is the incorrect allocation of the $10,000 on the balance sheet. Drawing this back into the inequitable division, it's important to note if you factor these in, that changes the amount of the division to 70-30, which is well beyond what is considered reasonable. Finally, very briefly, we urge this court to look at the facts with regard to custody. We don't believe the award was consistent with the child's best interests, and specifically, the court failed to make any detailed factual analysis to guide how it reached its decision, which we believe to be an abuse of discretion. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
May it please the court, Mr. Little. My name is Megan Zobel, and I represent the appellee, Mitchell Nelms, who joins us today with some of his family members as he continues to defend what he believes was the proper ruling in this case. As Mr. Little mentioned, there are three issues that Ms. Nelms raised in her appeal. That includes the classification of marital versus non-marital property, the division of the marital property, and then the award of physical custody to Mr. Nelms. Now, I understand Mr. Little discussed a number of issues with the marital versus non-marital property and division of the marital property, but we would like to first start with the most important issue to Mr. Nelms, and that is that the court did not abuse its discretion in awarding him sole physical custody. There are a number of factors that the court must consider, and we understand those best interest factors were mentioned several times today in court. Specifically, we believe that Ms. Nelms does not offer a stable environment for the minor child, and the effect that on the child as a result of disrupting an existing relationship that the move had on the minor child is a big factor, as well as the attitude and stability of each character. Now, instead of going into specific factors, because I would like to get to the financial situations, the arguments, I will ask the court to look over the briefs, look over the briefings, and look over the record, and find that there was not an abuse of discretion in awarding physical custody to Mr. Nelms. I'll first start off with the discussion about the non-marital property, the property that Ms. Nelms deems, I guess, as non-marital property, such as that of the Tahoe and that of the Suburban. Obviously, the first step in making an equitable division of the marital estate is to classify that property as marital or non-marital. That separate property becomes marital property by commingling it when it is inextricably mixed with marital property. That burden rests on Ms. Nelms to make that property non-marital. She argues she brought in over $178,000 worth of assets to the marriage. Mr. Nelms is not arguing that she brought in substantial assets to the marriage, and neither did the district court. I believe there was $118,000 set aside that she was able to trace of those premarital assets. The court properly set aside that $118,000 worth of premarital assets, and the burden rests on Ms. Nelms to account for the remaining premarital assets. She must prove that the property remained segregated, and she failed to do that. And she must prove that the property was not commingled, and she failed to do that as well. Ms. Nelms deposited specifically to the Tahoe $30,000 on September 2nd, 2014 into the party's joint checking account. Also included in that joint checking account was Mr. Nelms' paychecks from the city of Indianola, Ms. Nelms's income from her various jobs, and those are a little bit hard to track because, again, she had some cash income coming in. She had some deposits that we couldn't account for exactly what was going into the account. There was also an $8,718 joint tax return that was deposited into that same joint checking account on February 24th, 2015. And the Thrasher payment, I believe the final Thrasher payment was $8,400. That was taken out of the account in March of 2015. So it's about similar in the value of those two items. I'll briefly touch on Judge Arterburn's comment about whether or not the payments into the home, such as the Thrasher payment and the carpeting and those types of things, increase the value of the home, and if she should be given credit for that. And I do not believe that's correct, and I don't believe that's consistent with the case law. I don't think that treating the deposit or down payment on the marital home that clearly goes into the home is the same as updating that marital home. I will also say that Mr. Nelms contributed to updating that marital home. He contributed to helping install some of these things and helping do the renovations on that marital home, and he's not getting any credit for those types of things either. We also agree with opposing counsel that time, I think, is consistent with case law, that time should be a factor when considering whether assets can be traced or not. However, each case is unique, and I believe this case is unique in that circumstance when within that 8-month period of time between that $30,000 deposit and that last Thrasher payment, there was significant funds going in and out of that joint checking account. I will also make note that there were many times during that eight-month period that the account actually dipped below what it was prior to that $30,000 being deposited. And I would argue that that also makes it very difficult for Ms. Nelms to trace that premarital property back to her. As far as the Suburban goes, we do understand that there was possibly an error that the court had in calculating how he treated or how they treated the Suburban. And we would argue that regardless of how the court treats those assets, and I believe that both Mr. Little and myself have briefed that situation. However the court decides to treat it, we believe that it's still not an abuse of discretion. We believe that the division of the property is still equitable in that regard.
But you would agree, you did agree that the court made a mistake in how it
yes,
placed it in two places, as
yeah,
premarital and marital.
Correct. And I do, I do want to mention that I believe it was improper to use $16,000. I believe it's also improper to argue that it's worth the $18,000, and I think Mr. Little did concede to that. It should be the sale price that we should be looking at. I do not believe Mr. Nelms is arguing that that is a premarital property, and I believe that the court just treated that by, again, putting it in all both the marital property and then giving her credit for the premarital property. I do believe that was incorrect.
Was that matter addressed in post-trial motions?
I am unaware of that, Your Honor. I was not trial court.
Neither of you were trial counsel.
Correct, correct.
Could you address the refinancing issue? Was there evidence that your client was unable to refinance?
I think that the evidence before the court was his income. There was, I believe it's around $2,000, a little over $2,000 a month in income. And then as well as, taking into account that he was obligated on this large mortgage, and Ms. Nelms had, I think it was under maybe $5,000 worth of marital debt that was awarded to her, so the considerable debt difference between the two of them.
But he wanted the home.
He did want the home, Your Honor, yes. And I do not recall from my memory of the record whether or not there was ever the question asked about whether he would be able to refinance that property or not. And I apologize, I'm not sure if that was on the record or not. But I would say that given all of the circumstances of the case, including that large equalization judgment that Mr. Nelms is ordered to pay, I believe, one, it's likely that Mr. Nelms will have to refinance it in the future anyway to come up with that $40,000 cash payment to Ms. Nelms. I'll also note that that $40,000 cash payment to her, she's ordered to pay $10,000 of that. He was ordered right up front to pay $10,000 of that, and then annually. That's typical of courts taking into consideration the party's ability to pay that up front. It's also difficult for Mr. Nelms to make that payment. And so allowing him additional time and with interest, which I will add, that was included in the decree, and I believe argued that was not included. Those payments will be will accrue interest, and he will have to be able to make those payments annually after that first initial $10,000 payment. I also believe that in doing that, the court was considering the credibility of the witnesses. I believe there were many issues throughout the pendency of the divorce that led the court to maybe make the decision that it did regarding the division of the marital estate. Yes, the marriage was a short marriage. I believe the decree was filed in January of 2016. They didn't actually proceed with doing temporaries until the next year. And so during that time, they had tried reconciling several times. There were issues throughout that duration of the divorce, however, where Ms. Nelms deliberately sold off assets, even though she was ordered by the court not to do that. She also sold those assets without any notice to Mr. Nelms. She depleted the joint checking account several times, the joint checking account wherein both parties' incomes were going in throughout a large duration of the divorce. She also refused Mr. Nelms to move into the marital home when he expressed his interests to move in after she had moved herself and her son across to Cambridge. He had asked her to move in, and instead of allowing him that, he had to remain in his home, pay rent in his home. She had the marital home and then also her home in Cambridge that she purchased that they were paying for. And so instead of just allowing him to not have to pay rent in the home and allow him to move back into the marital home, she refused to allow that. Ms. Nelms also argues, I know that Mr. Nelms did not help with the mortgage during the pendency of the divorce, and that's simply not true. He was actually, his income was going into the joint checking account that was paying out that mortgage until I believe February of 2017. So that was occurring. Further, while the parties were together, they were married, they were sharing expenses during that time. They were also together prior to the marriage, renovating a premarital home owned by Ms. Nelms. And Mr. Nelms was contributing to those renovations. And I know, again, we don't have, you know, a division of non-marital property for that, but taking into account the equity of the situation, I do believe that the court made an equitable division of the marital estate, and I don't believe that was an abuse of discretion.
Thank you very much. How much time does the appellant have remaining for rebuttal?
1 second. You can't even get out of your chair.
May I attempt to use that second?
Well, I'd like to see how you're going to do that.
Mr. Nelms lied in his affidavit.
Wow.
That was pretty close.
Okay.
Thank you, counsel. We will obviously review the record and all of your briefing, and we appreciate your attendance here today. You are excused, and your case is submitted, and we are now in recess. Thank you.
And I would add, neither of you were trial
lawyers.
Yeah, neither of you were trial lawyers in this case, and I felt that you both represented the record very well. So thank you for that.
I think we were